Welcome to Once Upon a Story, a public health palliative care podcast from La Trobe University. Welcome back to Once Upon a Story, a podcast about life storytelling and the research that I've been doing into Eastern Palliative Care Biography Program. My name is Carly and my co-host is...
My name is Crystal Wallace and I work for EPC as part of their volunteer team. I am the volunteer services consultant there.
And it's great to be back chatting about this today. Last episode, I spoke a lot and I talked a little bit about the start of the research that I've been doing. We thought we might go back even further and talk a little bit more about the biography program. And we've called it the ethics of storytelling. And part of that is simply to do with what does it practically mean to tell your life story, and how does EPC approach that as a biography program, and what has that meant? Because I know that you yourself, but also the program, has a lot of experience in this. And this has greatly impacted the research that I've done. So it'd be really good to hear about that. So I was wondering, Crystal, could you tell us some of those maybe unique story? Let's begin with the unique stories of the biography, because this is a personalised program. So how have some people very uniquely told their life story through this program?
I've seen a wide variety of ways that people have chosen to engage with the program, really beautiful, beautiful ways as well. I'm thinking back over some of the stories that I've read and heard about as well. There was the example that we've got of a client, we call them clients, patient storytellers, who was dying and was aware, she didn't have grandchildren at the time, but she was aware in the future there would be grandchildren. She wanted them to know who grandma was, but she wanted them to be able to access her story early in their life. So clearly if she wrote it in the normal fashion, a five-year-old's not going to be able to understand what she's talking about. So she chose to retell her story in the form of creating characters around a kangaroo. So she had a name for herself. Every family member was a different kangaroo and had a different name.
So
we had an illustrator who was part of our biography team, and she did some simple children's illustrations, which was beautiful. There was another client we had who insisted, he was a huge passionate car collector of toy cars. His entire house had shelves and shelves and shelves of toy cars. He wanted them all listed. So it was 8 pages of single type of the name of the car, where it was bought, the year it was made, the colour of the car. And I think he actually verbally went through that list. There was another client who was telling her story in hospital. Her family were there with her. She stopped the storytelling process and she actually said to the biographer, I want you to actually write what you're seeing at the moment, because in the future I want my family to remember this moment in time. Now, fortunately, she had a biographer who was a creative writer as well. Mm-hmm. And so the single page writing reflection piece that the biographer did, very unusual for a biographer's voice to be heard, but it was beautiful in how she described the hospital scene and where the family were sitting and what was going on at the time.
Wow, such trust in her perceptive abilities, or the biographer's perceptive abilities.
Huge trust, because to my knowledge, the client would not have known that this was a creative writer that she was engaging with. There have been fun stories. One client was a passionate collector of birds, hopefully alive, but not all of them were. And so she went through this list of the first budgie flew away, the second budgie drowned in a tub of water in the laundry, the third budgie she was on a phone to her family and she stood on it. The fourth budgie, she was sitting on the floor, she got up to go and find the budgie, couldn't find it anywhere, and when she circled back, it was squashed in the carpet.
I feel like I interviewed somebody involved with this story.
You might have.
Because I've heard that story.
Yes. So, you know, but and then she humorously went on to say that her family have suggested perhaps she needs to collect bigger birds.
Right.
But it really very much is about what's important to the person. I've read stories that have been like scientific journals because that particular storyteller came from an academic science background and I've learned more than I probably need to know about microbiology or whatever the topic happened to be. And most interestingly now, because of course we've got the social media generation now moving into the palliative care space, they are choosing to want to bring in their illness journey that they have been tracking on social media sites and bring that into the storytelling process.
That is actually quite an interesting point because it's always going to be adapting, isn't it? This isn't sort of a set and forget sort of program because not only are the people individual, but the society is going to keep changing and our expectations of what it means to tell our life story is probably going to be quite different. I mean, generationally, but perhaps culturally as well, there could be massive differences in what people actually expect their story to look or sound like and what they include. If we titled this episode The Ethics of Storytelling, not only are the volunteer biographers trained sort of in general information about how to communicate with people and how they might approach the life storytelling process, but that has to be very sensitively navigated. I was wondering now if maybe there were some stories that have very concretely perhaps influenced how you or how volunteers have related to the program or adapted to expectations or anything like that, because I know there's quite a few variations that the program's gone through.
Yeah, that's correct. And what I love about the program is that on a meta level, it keeps being responsive to the client group that is presenting in front of it. So, you know, we have it on a intimate level between the biographer and the storyteller, but it's also happening back up at the meta level as well. So being a health organisation based in Victoria, we are governed by lots of different things, including the law, including mandatory reporting. So there's, you know, if certain information comes to us, then we are obliged to report it to the law. There are a number of sort of ethical pillars that we work with. So the first thing would be that we're non-judgmental. We're not going to sit in front of someone and tell them why their story is wrong. The second thing is we're responsive to need, as we've already touched on before. Thirdly, whose truth is being told? And this one's a really big one. And I know you touched on it in your research, and we even sort of skirted around it in our last episode. Does truth change depending on who the audience is, what the intent of the story is, and the intent of the storyteller, and the place and time in which the story is being told? Yeah. Our fourth one, which is one, probably one of the biggest ones that we're always on the alert for, is the principle of do no harm. So when we're thinking about do no harm, we're reflecting around who is the audience, and we're reflecting around vulnerable groups. So children who might be exposed to this story, people who have got mental health issues, multiple suicide attempts, maybe addiction, people who are living with addiction, people who might have some developmental processing issues as well. We need to be careful as an organisation that we are not releasing information that's going to damage those particular people. The other group that we are very mindful of do no harm to is the client themselves. So if I can give you a really practical example, it'll make sense. Very early on into my time with EPC, we had a young parent on our program, and she had gone through an acrimonious divorce, and her husband had custody of the two children who were under the age of seven. And she very clearly stated to us that her intent with the story was to record it all now, give it to her lawyer, and when the children were 18, they were to be given this story. And the reason she wanted to do it was she wanted to, it was a revenge story, basically. She wanted to tell the children exactly what their father was like and everything bad about him. Immediately, you can see where the problems are.
There's a lot of problems
that we've
there.
Got. And so we did everything we could to coach, cajole, plead, counsel her around those concepts. But she, due to some other things that she had going on, was unable to appreciate the ethics that we were talking about. She got very, very angry because she felt we were editing her story, which we were. And she almost actually fired the entire organisation from her care. That's how bad things got. So As a result of working with her, we realised very quickly that we needed to give people a heads up at the beginning of the storytelling process that there's certain pieces of information we may not be able to record as an organisation, that we will do everything we can to work with getting our family support workers, who are our counsellors, involved to see if there's another way that you can achieve the aim that you've got going there. But one of the positives out of that experience was we were able to launch into what we now call our children's picture book biography. So in her story, she had written some beautiful sentences about her kids, and we pulled those all out. We combined them with beautiful photos that she'd given us, and we then created a separate document that was going to sit alongside this other document. But a separate document that was far more appropriate for children at the age that they were. And that children's picture book biography part of our program is used by parents extensively, mainly to parent into the future. So you'll often read those stories and you'll hear them say things like, when you are approaching, firstly, you must go to university. When you're getting there, talk to Uncle Todd. He's the best one to guide you. Right. Or, you know, but they're using it as a way of going, not just this is who Mum was, but this is what I would advise you to do at each life stage. And I want to tell you. And it's also the most emotionally charged part of our work.
It's amazing that that one story had such a positive and sort of negative, well, two positives really, but that it drove such strong practical change in how you approach things, that really giving people a heads up about, we are an organisation, we are only going to do so much, that we have limits. If the individual wants to do something themselves, that's up to them. But also that development of the picture books, which I've seen some of them, and they are just gorgeous stories. I know that some grandparents have written them as well. And so they're beautiful, the way that they, have adapted the program and gone with the flow.
Absolutely. And what we're finding now is, because we're now alert to some of these issues, our biographers are skilled around navigating them. So I'm thinking of another client we had, and his intent when he wrote his story is, he had two adult children. One received chapters and chapters and chapters of glory. The other one, he said to the biographer, I want my son to know exactly where he went wrong in life and everything he did badly.
Oh dear.
And the biographer, after talking to us, because we do everything as a team, went back to him and said to him, who are you hoping to read this? And the reason why we didn't want all of that negativity in there, apart from the obvious, was we knew that the son also had multiple suicide attempts over his life. And so our duty of care became for the son, the reader, the audience. Sure. When she posed the question back to him, who are you writing this for? One of the groups he said was, oh, so my friends will know more about me. And she was able to jump into that space and say, do you really want your friends to have all of this information? Beautifully, at that point, the client went, oh, good point. No, I don't. And he chose to self-edit himself.
Yeah. And that's really interesting, that it was simply that change in perspective, that he was actually trying to do two things with one document.
Correct. Yeah. That's right. Another common request we'll have after the client has died is around voice recordings. And we'll have family come back to us and say, could we have the voice recordings? Now, ethically, that is a big challenge for us, because we are sitting under the confidentiality practices and laws that exist in Victoria. And when we work with our clients, we say to them, we're not going to be spreading this around. This doesn't go anywhere else. We also know if we say to the client ahead of time, we'll release the voice recordings, they start to self-edit.
Interesting.
And in the biography program, the magic is actually in the process of the storytelling, not the finished product. It's around having that freedom to say what you want to someone who's got no agenda, no emotional thing that you need to trip around. You can say who you do and don't like without any fear, but you're processing as you're talking.
Yeah.
But, you know, the carers were making a very key request there, and it's because they didn't have voice recordings. I can't remember how she used to speak anymore.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, we've brought in a process at the beginning of the storytelling. We say to the client, how about we just record your voice for 5 minutes with some really fun questions.
Yep. Nice.
Now, as far as the client's concerned, if they're thinking, they'll probably understand what we're doing, because we don't want to go in and lead with, you're dying, so let's, you know, that's not going to be helpful either. But it's just a very non-threatening way. And so then we're meeting the requests and requirements of both groups.
Yes, because I know that, given that the research takes a long time, and actually having done the surveys and the interviews quite a long time ago now, that was one of the common things in the surveys that came back, was that people wanted a voice or audio option. So that's a really, it's a lovely way of providing that while still maintaining that confidentiality or that freedom in those storytelling sessions, because that is also something that came very strongly through the research, was that there were opportunities just to talk. Yeah. And that was often just as important as anything else that happened, that process product deal is a package deal.
Yeah.
And that process is really important. And people appreciate, being able to perhaps tell some stories sometimes and then get to the end of it and go, oh, maybe not.
Yes.
Or maybe just part of it or something like that.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's why we go through this circular thing, as we talked about last week, Carly, that your research mirrored about the storytelling process being a constant. Mm. So with the biographer, they're constantly checking back in with the client. Yep. Are you happy with where we got to last week? Is there anything you want to take out? Anything you want to put back in? We did face some... We have some issues when clients die before we've delivered the biography to them, because it becomes part of their estate, mm-hmm. and it becomes quite awkward for us as an organisation, because of course clients might have died, their family are ringing up and saying the funeral's in 3 days, could I have the material? And we're having to say, actually we need copies of the will, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so we've had to do some work around that as well, about how do we find ways to have that material there for them, that they don't need to go through all of that legal side of life that sits there. And those are all the secrets of this program, where if anyone would like to be trained by us, I will happily reveal.
Yeah, there's a lot of specific processes that you as an individual organisation have to put into place that may not necessarily be what other organisations would have to do, is it? Because it is... There's so many things to consider.
That's right.
It's not just storytelling. As much as it sounds like quite a simple process, there are a lot of background complexities.
Yeah.
And that's been one of the things that I've found really interesting in the research. Maybe I'll just check, first of all, are there any just quick stories you want to continue with, or... Any unique stories?
That really captures a lot. There was one other place, though, that I was thinking just recently in the last year. We have had a number of carers say to us after the death, I wish I had a chance to tell my story.
Good point, yeah.
And so a year ago we commenced a pilot project. We've called it Chapter 2, mm-hmm. which is allowing our bereaved carers to tell their story. Great. And that's about to finish. I'm about to do the write-up on what we've found through that process. They use the storytelling process very differently to clients. They do a lot of reflection around the relationship and who that person was in relation to them and what that all meant. They do the usual that you'd expect, you know, the childhood stories and things like that, but a vast majority of it seems to be taken up with them using that as a way of processing their loss and their grief and finding their new identity. So connecting back with what were the strengths pre my relationship with this person? So who was I back then? Because maybe if I can remember that, I now have courage and hope, the lessons I've learnt there, the resilience I can see going through my narrative gives me hope that I can now move forward into this new space of loss and redefining again now who I am in the world.
Yeah, that's really amazing, because it sounds very similar to what I experienced in the carer interviews as well, in that I very much felt like that those interviews became that very same thing. They were an opportunity for the carer to retouch on that experience and debrief a little bit about that. So that's really interesting that that's been your observations, even just from the pilot program. There's some very interesting research that could be done about all of this.
Contact us on.
I feel like there could be more research that could be done about this. But connecting perhaps back to the research a little bit more about, because this was part of what I was very interested in that EPCs had to make a whole series of decisions about how to deal with both good and difficult experiences that you've had. And while you have put into place certain quite specific policies, things that are sort of guided quite directly, there's also a great deal of adaptability about those
There's and a huge playing field.
A lot of those things are, well, in this instance, we might do it like this. But with all these other variables, we then need to maybe think a little bit differently about how we respond to that. And I know that there's a lot of communication between yourselves as the staff, volunteer staff, and then the volunteers about how that process happens and that you support them and walk with them in that whole process. And I found that really interesting because, as I think we mentioned just in the last episode, there's been very little research published about programs like this. And when I did read some articles that touched on programs that were similar, they would occasionally mention that there might have been an issue, maybe a bereaved family wasn't super happy with what was written about them. Or that there was the volunteer, I think one of the others was that a volunteer felt that the patient had perhaps overstepped their expectation, or the family had overstepped the expectation of what they expected of that volunteer to be able to do. But what I found interesting was that there was very little comment on how that was practically dealt with. Now, part of that is probably to do with the word count of published articles, that there's a limit to what you can do. But I also thought it was interesting that they didn't go into that at all, and that EPC had this quite wealth of information about how you have dealt with it. So I found that really interesting to look at that and to begin to learn how you'd approached all of those things.
That's right, because you want to actually honour the storyteller. And I'm thinking now about, you know, the stories that come through involving, say, sexual abuse. Mm. And in the period of time that we're telling our story in Australia, we've gone through the Royal Commission around institutional sexual abuse, and there's been a lot of those kind of stories that have come through as well. And how do we honour the storyteller and not cause them harm by refusing to put certain parts in the story, but at the same time needing to protect the organisation from libelous claims, at the same time sticking within the law that we have? And sometimes it's as simple as just moving parts of the story around, separating it out. Obviously, if something has gone through the courts and it's on public record, absolutely fine.
Sure.
We're happy to print and go with it. I'm thinking of one person who actually wanted to put a photo of the person who had sexually abused them. And, you know, we had to think carefully around that, because this person had been up in court in another state of Australia, but not in Victoria and not for this particular case. So having to think through this myriad of stuff that's coming in all the time from different spaces and places.
And that duty of care that you spoke of, that it's for everybody. It varies in perhaps maybe where your focus is, but that there is a wide range of duty of care that I know that you all feel quite responsible for, like you, that do no harm. You don't want anyone to come out of this worse. This is meant to be a good opportunity, even if it's a reflective one or one where people assess or whatever it is, however they engage with it. But ideally, it's meant to be a meaningful and engaging opportunity for people to do what it is that they need to do. But there's all these other aspects that we then have to think about. And I found that very interesting to observe how you didn't create protocols or absolutes, but you had this whole, you had a philosophy. That's how I've spoken about it. You had a philosophy. And that is what came out really strongly in my research that I was initially surprised about. I shouldn't have been surprised. I now look back and go, no, this is quite logical that it all happened the way that it did. But I began writing your philosophy, or EPC's biography's philosophy, without realizing that's what I was doing, and suddenly went, oh, no, actually, I'm writing what I perceive as your philosophy and trying to put words and concepts to all those things that you've just spoken about without defining it within a specific protocol that is immovable.
That's right. And I think you and I have touched on the question of, if we had a different organisation or a different person heading up the program, would we have developed to the point that we're in at the moment?
Yeah.
And I think we realised we probably wouldn't. I mean, a lot of, if I can speak personally for the moment, I am a person who is open and I don't like stickiness. I like challenging the rules. So, and I'm not into, you know, every full stop and comma. Now that drives people nuts, and yeah. I have to be very mindful about that.
Sure.
But I think when you've got a broad approach, when you're prepared to keep moving, keep interpreting, keep changing, do it in collaboration with people, you know, engage and adapt, you get a much stronger, richer program. We could have gone, EPC could have gone down the road of there's 75 million policies and processes and rules,
and that's it.
And I know there are other storytelling traditions out there that do go that way.
Mm.
I personally find that very confining and doesn't give you a lot of room to capture the full person.
Yeah. But this also requires a bit of work and negotiation, doesn't
it? Courage.
it's an ongoing process. And maybe, well, we might wrap up in a moment, but maybe since we've chatted about it, I will perhaps very briefly overview how I describe the philosophy, if that's all right, if
That'd
I can
be
remember. now I've written it, I have to remember it. But I've written obviously a lot more about these in much more detail. And in some ways it sounds very simple, but it's the simplicity that makes it complex. It's one of those weird paradoxes. And I begin right back with the whole palliative care, that it is person-centered. And I write about how it's not client-centered, it's person-centered, and that it's about personhood, which transposes that duty of care from being simply about the client. Obviously, that's very important, but that it also expands. It doesn't lose anything, but it expands to everybody else who's also involved. The second element that I wrote about is that there's a general and very basic recognition that we can learn, develop, grow, engage, or however you want to think about it, at any stage of life. Now, this is obviously something that has to do with people who are receiving palliative care. So you don't assume that everything stops at all. Life actually does keep going in its weird way while you're receiving palliative care. But it also is very noticeable with the volunteers. I noted that is why I phrased it that way, I think, was because it's very inclusive of the volunteers. You recognise that they come with a wealth of experience already, but that they also then probably have to learn some new skills, and that there's this ongoing development that the volunteers go through as well, where they share advice amongst each other, they learn, there's new technology that's always happening that they're having to adapt to. So there's that very basic concept that nothing is ever
static.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. Nothing is ever really static. The third one is relation, that it's relational. And again, that was very clear to me quite early. Even I struggled, I think, to know how to define it, but it really is that it's all about relationship. Obviously, that key relationship is between the storyteller and the volunteer, but that's definitely not the only one. There's key relationships between the volunteers and you as staff, but then there's volunteers between carers and staff, and there's this quite delicate balancing act that everyone has to go through. And it's different, I imagine, for every single person that you come across. And you have to maintain, or not you have to, but you do maintain quite deliberate relationships with your volunteers.
Correct.
And I've really admired how the staff put such a lot of effort into that. And I don't mean effort in a bad way, effort in that it's difficult, but that it's, you notice that it's important.
Yeah.
And I really feel that you guys recognise how valuable that process is. And then the final one is, and this was the absolute most difficult one for me to define. It took me a long time, and yet it is also very obvious, is that it's a creative process.
Correct.
It is entirely a creative process. This is not a clinical program at all, in the way that we think about clinical medical programs that define individual aspects of disease and sort of define each of us into our individual parts of what's wrong with us, that this is a creative process that encompasses so much. And so those four aspects, that it is person-centered, that everyone can learn and develop, that it's relational and that it's creative, have really come together for me to describe how this program operates. And I feel that that can be transposed to lots of different things, but I've tried to relate it in a very specific way to the biography program.
That's absolutely correct. And it sounds simple.
It does.
And it's really complicated to implement and even more, as you found, even more complicated to research around and study.
Yeah, because there's so many things involved with that. It's so interdisciplinary in how to approach that because it involves all of the parts of our life.
And yet I would say EPC has proved it is the best model for this type of work.
Yeah, somehow it all works.
Yes.
Entirely within what is otherwise a health
correct
organisation.
That's
which
correct.
Which is very interesting. I think we might wrap up there for today. And I just realised I don't know what we're speaking about next time. Let me get it. Next time, the next episode, we're going to expand on the relationship and the collaboration, which is actually very logical and makes entire sense. So next week we'll expand a bit more on that relationship, the collaboration that the process involves, and I think probably a little bit on that creativity element as well. But otherwise we might end there. If there are any questions that you have about today or any of the other episodes that we have, we'll have all the information about how to contact us in the show notes. Otherwise, thank you very much for being with us today. We hope you've enjoyed it and we hope you'll come back for the next episode. Thank you. This research is supported by a La Trobe University Research Scholarship, funded in part by Eastern Palliative Care Incorporated. It is being carried out in partial fulfilment of a PhD research under the supervision of Dr. Bruce Rumbold, Dr. David Azul, and Dr. Fiona Gardner, and previously Dr. Susan Finesse. The researcher conducting the research is Carly Edgar. You can find out more about Eastern Palliative Care at epc.asn.au. You can find out more about La Trobe at latrobe.edu.au. This has been a La Trobe University podcast, produced in Melbourne, Australia, and on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people, and with thanks to Matt Bourne as our recording engineer.